When black clouds loom on the horizon and thunderstorms appear to hurtle down the valley, the foster father of Krishna tells Radha, a girl slightly elder than his boy, to take him home. The boy and the girl start walking back home along the riverbank. On the way, as the darkness thickens in the dense forest, flames of passion flare up. The eternal desire to unite into oneness sweeps through the craving bodies. Now, on the surface, the narrative may appear plainly erotic, but the underlying spirit holds the very essence of mysticism. When such a story is captured on paper as an image, the artist must be united with the spirit of the narrative, and the painting must paint itself. Such an image cannot be depicted through mundane reality as we encounter through our bare eyes, because under the surface of the narrative lies a profound meaning, an eternal truth, a subtle wisdom, and the ultimate secret of existence. This is the beginning of the 12th century poetic text Gita Govinda, composed by Jayadeva. And a Pahari artist of 18th century captured this in a painting of fascinating charm and mystery. In the painting, the entire landscape is dark. The trees appear black against black or deep blue. Stars blink through a festive canopy-like sky. It is a celebration of nature, where the whole existence appears to converge at the unification of Radha and Krishna, as if the entire expanse of nature is emanating from them. The folio stands for the truth that unification with the Supreme Godhead engulfs the infinite within oneself. And the most counterintuitive aspect is the bright visibility of Radha and Krishna when there is no source of light around. This kind of depiction must have puzzled the European viewers in the early days, because in the Western way, artists spent a long time considering how to show the interplay between light and shadow. But for the Indian artist, it was not a concern at all, because his mission was to depict the spirit that in pitch darkness too, the union with the Supreme lightens up the inner world. No external glow is necessary in such a union. I narrated such a story to set up the backdrop of Indian painting. Unlike Mughal or Western ways, Indian paintings, even if revolved around religious myth, had to take recourse of symbolism and hence distortion of mundane reality on paper or leaf or wood blocks. And since a large body of works by Pahari artists depicted the life of Krishna, the paintings are necessarily meant to be interpreted through the tapestry of symbols arranged one above the other. After all, the story of Krishna's life is the ultimate essence of mystic worldview. The great mural tradition of India prevailed for almost 800 years since the days of Ajanta caves. The Islamic invaders knocked the door of the Hind after just 90 years of Muhammad's founding Islam. It was 8th century. Then the Sultanate followed. The Sultans were not much of patron of art. Hence, the early Islamic rulers did not take the cause of art forward during their rule in India. But they brought a priceless gift with them, papers. At least we can assume that the idea of paper must have been introduced to the Indians when Islam stepped onto Indian soil. Paper manufacturing began around 13th century, not before that. The early flash of Indian painting, not influenced by the Mughals, date back to 11th century. The trade route linking the Indian subcontinent and Central Asia passed through Gujarat and Rajasthan. The merchants and tradesmen of these regions became wealthy and indulged in art. They were Jains and naturally were interested in the life of the Tirthankaras. The illustrated manuscripts produced in this part of the country were always about the Jain religious narratives. The style was more or less consistent with the earlier mural tradition, where the purpose was to represent the objects or people as less confusingly as possible. Everything painted from the most characteristic view. Of course, a peculiar trait is noticed in Jain paintings that remain unexplained. They painted elongated eyes projecting beyond the contour of the face. We do not know exactly why, and the rules and guidelines must have been extremely tight. The artist had to operate within such boundary without deviation. See, the painting is showing Mahavira's mother Trishala dreaming of 14 objects when she conceives Mahavira. Now I repeat, she is dreaming of 14 objects. Can anybody dream with eyes open? No. But the compulsion to paint the eye in a certain manner is so intense that even a sleeping pair of eyes of Trishala were painted in the same way, with eyes open. At this point, I am tempted to draw your attention to something peculiar. Most of the paintings of Mahavira or Buddha during Middle Ages are with eyes open, whereas more or less all the Buddha sculptures made during this period are with eyes half closed. I am saying most because I could not find an exception. After all, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Hence, I must salute to the mass producers of Buddha paintings in India these days. Every other artist keeps rolling out Buddha in dozens with half-closed eyes in India. Of course, they do so because Buddha sells in the market. What an irony, eh? Buddha would have flashed a smile of sarcasm at this defeating of exactly what he preached. In this reference, I also remember a prayer written on the colophon page of some ancient manuscript containing profound wisdom. Remember, all such manuscripts were made of palm leaves. The most important page is called the colophon page, where the title of the patron, the author, and other important details used to be mentioned. But unfortunately, most colophon pages did not survive the ravage of weather and time. Well, this one did. The colophon page had this prayer written on it. It was a prayer by the manuscript. Protect me, O Lord, from oil, from water, from fire, and from poor binding. And save me from falling in the hands of fools. Anyhow, Indian art took a curious turn 15th century onwards. Incidentally, it is the period when Mughal too arrived in India, and the Mughal court being highly passionate about art, a new school of painting took off, Mughal school. But at the same time, Rajput kingdoms and Himalayan states under the influence of the Rajput dynasty began to support the cause of painting too. The kings in the hilly terrains became the patrons of artists. We call such artists as Pahari artists. But unlike the Mughals, the Rajput patrons wanted the large body of mythologies to be painted instead of their own adventures or achievements. Hence, there came the need to depict a whole lot of paintings of Krishna's life. Now, let me lay down a few salient features of the paintings by Pahari artists, or let's say Indian paintings without contamination of Mughal style. To begin with, let us consider the concept of time. As explained in an earlier episode, time in Hindu concept is actually timeless. Time is a static continuum stretching from horizon to horizon. We mortals walk over it and feel that we are standing still, but time is passing by. A story from Vishnu Purana can explain the idea better. Once the great god Vishnu, while wandering the earth, came across Narada, the sage. Vishnu asked Narada to fetch some water from the nearby village. Narada went to the village and fell in love with the first woman he saw. He married the woman and settled in a happy life with kids as time passed. One day, a devastating flood swept through the village. Even Narada was swept away. As he got back to senses, he blinked his eyes open and realized that he was at the same spot where he had met the great god Vishnu. Vishnu was standing right there looking at him. Vishnu asked him, "Where is my water, son?" Now, this story implies that time was passing by for Narada because he was running around, whereas for Vishnu, time stood still. Having unbound faith in the Almighty brings the subject to the now. Greed, desire, lust vanish because all those are anchored in the future. Sorrow, anger, jealousy disappear because such feelings are rooted in the past. Being in the present all the time means one can depict an object on the same canvas at different locations at the same time. It is not the same in the Islamic art or Mughal painting because the concept of time is linear as in the Western outlook. Space in Indian concept is also counterintuitive to the Western view. The Supreme is infinite and the abode of the infinite is inside each of us. It begins with "I love God" and ends in "I am God." This way there is nowhere one can go because one is everywhere. How can there be a fixed vantage point in space to look at a scene? The idea of fixed vantage point is central to drawing an image with proper perspective in terms of the Western way. But for an Indian artist, it does not matter from where various objects are being seen. The view of each object can be anywhere and different from that of another object in the same painting. This is a deliberate philosophical choice of the artist. Finally, I must mention the unique way of painting landscapes. In Gita Govinda, the same river is described in different form and spirit based on the mood and spirit of the lovers, Radha and Krishna. The reader ends up looking at nature colored by the spirit of the characters in action. In the Western art, during the pre-Renaissance period, nature makes hardly any serious appearance or acts as a mere backstage, whereas in Indian art, mankind and nature flow seamlessly into each other. Of course, nature is rarely depicted without any human or divine character in action in Indian art as well. But we can look at it as the view that mankind is not separate from nature but an integrated part of it. One example of a folio can be considered for a curious reason. Manaku of Guler court painted the Sandal Mountain briefly mentioned in Gita Govinda. It was unlikely that he saw any sandalwood plant but definitely had a sensational image of the mountain in his mind. He probably heard that snakes remained coiled around the trunks of sandalwood plants drawn by the fragrance of the same. Now, the romantic yet tantalizing image of the mountain could not be painted in a realistic manner. Hence, he painted some part of it in yellow, some in pink, some in red, and so on. But in reality, such mountains don't exist, right? Is it not similar to what the fobs like Flemings or Matisse did in early 20th century in the West? Or even we can take the reference of Van Gogh painting the room in the yellow house. The walls of the room or the bed were not of the same color as he painted. The colors suited the spirit of the expression that he wanted to convey. Now let us consider the idea of portraiture among the Indian artists. Unlike the Western or Mughal tradition, the Indian artists did not bother about likeness of external appearance. They were concerned about the salient characteristics or traits of the person. For instance, if it was a king they were portraying, they painted the man with classic features of a king's bearing. For example, the king usually had aquiline nose, arched eyebrows, large lotus-like eyes, broad chests, narrow waist. Usually, such a king would be painted against a flat background so that nothing else would draw the viewer's attention. But yes, this kind of idealized images rendered portraits of every king alike, just the way ancient Greek sculptures of different individuals looked identical. If you look at the portraits of Kripal Pal of Vasoli or Sid Sen of Mandi or Jaswant Singh of Marwar, you will find the same face appearing in all three. I am sure they did not look like twin brothers. But there is a subtle difference here. The intent of Indian artists were to depict the spirit of the man they painted, whereas the intent of Greek artists of ancient era was to avoid incorporating any unique expression or feature that would deviate the royal's look from the ideal. Hence, I shall say the Indian way was more akin to the concept of portraiture in modern days. Now, we may question, why only the portraits of kings and royals? Why only Radha and Krishna? Why not common folks? Here comes the irony. Painting those days was not an easy affair. One might have been able to get hold of palm leaves easily, but then ink or paint could not be applied directly on the raw leaf. The leaf was to be treated with specialized techniques to enable it to accept the scrawl or coat of paint. The knowledge was not commonplace, but remained restricted within the families that enjoyed art as a vocation for generations. Of course, there was paper at a later date, but it is easy to understand that paper was not available in abundance at a throwaway price like these days. Then comes the question of paints. Paints with 48 color tones were not available in the art materials store nearby. Paint was made by the artists themselves from obscure raw materials often. For instance, the brightest of yellow was supposedly made from urine of a cow with bad liver. Blue was made from stones like lapis lazuli, black from lamp black or antimony. The procedures were not at all simple and easy. Neither were they known to the public in general. Hence, there was a massive entry barrier to painting during the Middle Ages in India. Therefore, painting was restricted to the families devoted to this activity for generations, and they survived from the payment they received from their patrons, like the royals or kings, for painting what the kings wanted. Of course, other than kings, there must have been religious communities commissioning such works. One could not have taken up painting just out of fancy, unlike the kids of modern times. This is why the paintings we come across are mostly religious in nature, or that of royals of the kingdom. Needless to say that art survived during this period too, because some people had the skill and it kept the fire in the kitchen burning. But all said and done, let me conclude by mentioning something very important. How art was defined in Natya Shastra, an ancient scripture of the Hindus. It says that rasa lies in the heart of art. Rasa does not have an exactly equivalent word in English. However, we can say that rasa means flavor or essence or spirit. Now, what does rasa do? When someone views an artwork, rasa is supposed to invoke the bhav, a feeling or an emotional state in the viewer. Such emotional states could be classified as follows: erotic, humorous, compassionate, furious, heroic, fearsome, or repulsive. Imagine one of the options of bhav is repulsive. This means in the early Indian guideline, art is not necessarily to be beautiful, but it can invoke any of the aforesaid feelings when encountered, just like the way art is evaluated in the contemporary world. In fact, in this definition, beauty is not even mentioned in the least. One more aspect is chamatkara. While experiencing a piece of art, if some feeling hits the viewer like a flash of lightning in swift stroke, then that is called chamatkara. Chamatkara makes an artwork stand out in crowd. And imagine, this is exactly what many of today's conceptual or performance art do. The shock treatment, the surprise, the sudden revelation of some insight, like a Zen koan. Considering this definition, I think ancient Indian outlook about art was way ahead of time compared to the West. What the Western world arrived at in 21st century was realized by the Indian sages 2000 years ago. But sadly, Indians have forgotten to be themselves during the 4 centuries of Mughal rule and then 200 years of British rule. Today, half of the artists in India spend their lives trying to draw a mango exactly like a mango and break their heads on how light is falling on which fold of the cloth from what angle. Chamatkara and Rasa have taken a backseat. Perhaps in the coming days, large section of Indian artists will emerge with their own identity, shrugging off the hangover of the past 6 centuries. However, let us see what comes next. In my next episode, I shall talk about Mughal art. Wait until then.